Ethnically Ambiguous is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Hello, hello, hello.
Hi, Shireen.
Hi, Anna. Today is a very exciting episode. I've been looking forward to this ever since we booked him. It's Maz Jobrani. Oh yes, my God.
It's a really great episode.
What a fucking legend. He is the nicest person maybe I've ever met. We had technical issues at the top of this episode, and he was so kind and patient. And this is a great episode. We talk about his upbringing, how he found comedy, and how he formed the comedy group, The Axis of Evil, and so much more, including his new podcast.
Yeah, I mean, dream guest. So stay tuned, get excited.
Maz.
It's Maz.
Who are we? Where do we come from? Who do we become? What is it to be? What to be is it? Where are we? Who are my parents? Where are my pants? Why were we born? We are Ethnically Ambiguous.
Hi, Shireen.
Hey, Anna, how are you?
Good, how are you doing?
Good. Let's just pretend we didn't have 30 minutes of audio mishap with our very esteemed guest that I was looking forward to all fucking week to talk to. But technical difficulties aside, I'm very excited about today.
Look, it wouldn't be Ethnically Ambiguous if it wasn't a shit show in some way. God.
So true. But I did tell my entire family that I was talking to this guest today. No pressure.
Oh, damn. Should I have done that too?
I mean, they were just as excited as I was, if not more. I have never used so many exclamation marks. But there's a reason why this figure, I feel like, is pivotal for so many Middle Eastern kids growing up. I don't know what... I feel like he was the first time I had heard any like mention of being Middle Eastern on TV. Do you relate to that?
Oh, this is like, for a very long time, the only Iranian comedian I've ever heard of. And it was like next level to me where I was like, no, his parents would never let him do that.
Yeah. And I'm not, I don't know if he realizes I'm not Iranian because my name is Shireen, but I'm actually Syrian. But there was still, I have a kinship to the Persian culture. Yeah. The name June is the cutest thing in the world. Even though I'm not Persian, I want everyone to call me Shireen June. Without further ado, he's just standing by hearing us talk about him. Today, we are talking to Maz Jobrani!
Yay! How are you guys?
Hello, Anna June.
Hi, hello, Shireen June.
Oh my God, my heart. Wait, say that one more time.
Shireen June. Habibti.
Oh my God, my heart just skipped a beat. Thank you so much for doing the show.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks for having me on, you guys. Thank you. Yeah, and we weathered the technical stuff and here we are.
And yeah, I will
say my dad would always be like, oh, Maziar. He always yells at me every time I say it, or I don't pronounce a Persian name with enough screaming in your face. I'd be like, okay, dad, it's cool.
Yeah, you got to get it right. You got to get it right. And it's actually funny because Maz is short for Maziar. Mm-hmm. But I think sometimes even Iranians try to westernize it and they go, Maz. I go, it's not Maz, it's Maz.
Yeah,
right.
Or one of my biggest pet peeves is when Americans will say, Iran. Are you from Iran?
Oh, right.
I go, what are you, from America?
Iran
and Iraq.
Iraq. Oh,
Iraq.
God.
Yeah. Well, whatever.
Hard E.
Americans.
Hard white, E white. On the eye.
Yeah. But
hard E.
Do you know that you have this like iconic place for a lot of Middle Eastern children? Like, I don't know if you realize how literally iconic you are in so many families that I can even just like think of in my brain. I think representation is so few and far between, but you had this magical presence, especially back then. But did you feel like you had any pressure on your shoulders being maybe like the sole Persian comedian people knew?
I didn't feel any pressure. I, in all honesty, when you say, do I realize iconic, I was just doing my thing.
Of course.
And yeah. It's interesting because you run into some people sometimes that go, oh my God, I used to listen to you when I was a kid, this, that, the other. And then you go, oh my God, I feel old. Or I've run into recently a few people who are like, I've never heard of you. And I go, wait, you're Iranian? You don't ever heard of me? No. And I'm like, oh, I gotta come up with something new. But it's just, you know, it's generational. And but more importantly, I was just doing what I wanted to do, which is rare in our culture to actually go that path. Not that it's super rare, but it's more rare. Mm-hmm. So that, for example, when I come across some, you know, a Syrian American who says, oh, I'm an artist or an Iranian who says, I'm a DJ or whatever, a Palestinian who says, I'm a poet. I always go, that's fantastic. I get so excited. So similarly for me, it took me a while of battling my family's desires for me to be a lawyer, doctor, engineer, mm-hmm. and then going down this path. And once I was down this path, everything was a victory to me. And a few times I think people might have said like, oh, you're representing us, this and that. And I quickly would say, no, I'm not trying to represent anybody, because if you want me to if you want me to represent you, I will disappoint you at some point.
Right.
Which is happening now. I mean, it's like, I'm very left-leaning with my politics. So I'm very anti-Trump, and there's a lot of Iranians who like Trump and they get disappointed at me. And I go, look, I am me and I have reasons for the way I think and the way I feel. I was one of the first ones out the gate. Mm-hmm. There was Omid Jalili out of England, and then there was me over here. And then there was Ahmed Ahmed and Aaron Kader, who were part of the Axis of Evil, but they weren't Iranian. But anyway, this crew together, we were first in a way. And so there's definitely something that comes with that, but you cannot, in my opinion, you cannot take on this mantle of, I will represent our people. I'll represent my voice, and hopefully that will make the people that are followers, you know, proud or happy or whatever that is. But there's a lot of issues that our people are very conservative. Like, I would do jokes that would, in the joke, I'd be showing my support of the gay community, LGBTQ community. Mm-hmm. And I would have some Middle Easterners who did not see the world that way. And I was like, I don't know what to tell you. Or even when it comes to religion, when I did my immigrant special, which is my last Netflix special, I intentionally said that I'm not really religious. I'm Muslim-ish. Mm-hmm. And I do a whole joke about it because I don't want, I would love to be able to say, look, there's a lot of great Muslims that I know, and there's a lot of good people I know, and I meet them at my shows, and they're awesome, and I love them, and they're there, and they're laughing, and there's all levels of them. Some are more pious, some are less pious. But I don't want to say, oh, I'm Muslim, and then have someone come up to me after the show and say, well, why are you drinking alcohol, mm-hmm. or why did you do this, or why? You know what I'm saying? So you got to be careful how they...
Yeah, I think people are quick to label, and they're quick to try to put you in a box, especially if you're a person of color. But yeah, there are gradients to being Muslim. I really related to when you said you were Muslim-ish, because that's how I feel. I'm very ish.
Yeah.
But I do appreciate that you, like, as a Syrian, like, I'm a filmmaker, I'm a poet, I'm a writer. That was very against the grain. I mean, for me, it was terrifying to go against the grain. My sister is a doctor, and my dad was an engineer, and Anna's dad is also an engineer. So
it's my mom. Both parents are engineers.
Yeah.
Never had a chance.
I really appreciate that you just kept going. And for me, representation is like, we have to just represent ourselves. You're completely right. And I'm representing someone that the kid version of myself would be happy with, you know? And I think that's why for a lot of this time, I shied away from even mentioning I was Muslim or Syrian in any of my work, because it's just like, then you're representing that. Right. But I want to get into, I also want to talk to you about the Axis of Evil, because that was also just brilliant. But let's just rewind. Let's just go all the way back and talk about young Maz. Where were you born? Where did you grow up?
I was born in Iran, and my family left Iran late 78 as protests were happening in the streets of Iran, which led to the revolution in 79. So a lot of people, my father was a successful businessman in Iran, and a lot of people, I don't think, thought that the revolution was going to happen. They thought that the Shah would quash it as protests had happened in the past. So my dad was on business in New York, and he told my mom, why don't you bring the kids, me and my older sister, why don't you bring them to New York for their winter break of 78 mm-hmm. and stay with me for a little bit, and then you guys can go back as protests kind of die down. Well, the protests didn't die down, and this is actually a pretty common story that we hear from a lot of Iranians who came to America in the late 70s, early 80s. They say, like me, they say we came for 2 weeks and we stayed for 40 years. Mm-hmm. That's one of the reasons why I am so sympathetic to anyone fleeing a bad situation. Anytime there's an immigrant situation or there's a refugee situation or political asylum, I really err on the side of sympathy and empathy and go, hey, these people that are walking hundreds or thousands of miles with a caravan to come to America, they're not living a great life, a safe life where they live, and just saying, oh, we have a great life here in Honduras. Let's get up and go somewhere where they don't speak our language and they don't want us. No, they're going through a lot of problems, a lot of trouble, and they're coming here for a better life. So that's really at the core, I think, of why I stand up. I mean, in my stand up, a lot of times I say I'm an immigrant, and I am. I am an immigrant. And so I try to stand up for all immigrants wherever they're coming from. So that's where I was born. And then I grew up in Northern California, Marin County, which was a very wealthy area. My father was able to bring a lot of his money from Iran to America. That was a good first few years.
Yeah.
Those first 10 years or so from the basically late 70s, early 80s until the early 90s, we lived really well. But my father lost a lot of his money in bad real estate investments. So in the early 90s, he went back to Iran to try to do business, to try to make some money again, get things going again. And by then, we were already in college. Mm-hmm. I was already in college. And so, you know, overall, I've had a very good life. I never struggled in many ways in terms of financially. Mm-hmm. And even when I was in college and maybe, you know, eating pasta or beans or whatever, it was never like, oh, I got to live in a car or something, because mm-hmm. I always worked. My sister was older than me, but I was the oldest son. And mm-hmm. coming from our cultures, the patriarchal culture that we live in, my father really had instilled in me this idea of you got to work, you got to hustle, this and that. So I was always, I had a date, you know, I always had a couple of jobs going, you know, some kind of income coming. And that was kind of it.
Yeah, I mean, my parents kind of went through the exact same thing. They came to America to go to college. The revolution happened. And then everyone in their family was like, just stay. You have an American college degree. Like, you should just stay. But, like, I can't imagine, like, my parents are the only people from their families that came to America. Like, they're like, okay, yeah. Now we just start over. We learn the language and we just move forward. And that's there's such a strong mindset that comes with that. That, like, you know, when I think about it, I'm like, I'm so weak. How would I do that? But then, like, I was talking to my dad about this. He's like, I don't know. You moved to LA against all our wishes and just started working in the entertainment industry. And I was like, you're right. I'm very like you. Thanks, Dad. I bet you don't like that now. But it's true. It's a tough life. You just give it all up and say, I want something else that's not offered or just I can't have in this other place. And you just go, you move forward and you just do what you can.
And humans are resilient. We're resilient. We move forward. I think it's harder the older you get. So mm-hmm. like what you just said with, you know, with your parents, you know, you, when you're younger and you say, I'm 18, I'm going to move to New York and figure it out. Mm-hmm. You run into a whole bunch of bohemians running around and you guys are making it work. Mm-hmm. People that come later, like my parents came, my father was in his early 40s, didn't speak the language. My mom didn't speak the language. They had to learn the language, had to find friends, had to get used to the culture. That's one of the reasons my father went back after 10 years, because he still understood the way that Iran worked, even though it was all of a sudden under a completely different type of political system where it was an Islamic regime. He still understood the ways of, you know, you want to get something done, you got to bribe the guy at the front door. You want to, you know, you want to go have lunch, you go to your cousin's who lives right next door. You go spend 3 hours eating lunch together. I mean, it's just the system is very different. And for us, I was 6 years old when I came, so I adapted right away. That was fantastic. I'm playing. There's all kinds of toys. There's cartoons. Back in Iran in the late 70s, cartoons were like a half an hour in the afternoon, and that was it. You come to America, there's like 5 hours of cartoons. I mean, it was just like, oh my God, what an amazing. And then of course you're going to learn the language right away, but human beings are resilient. And that's why, you know, you hear the success stories of people who come and they set up shop and they do well. And again, I have sympathy for people looking for a better life. I mean, why wouldn't you support somebody that's doing that? And that doesn't mean that they're all going to come here and succeed. Some are going to come and find it difficult. But I think as a country, what I would like to put out there is a country that's whose arms are open to helping people, as opposed to someone who says, I'm afraid that a bad apple might come through as well. Therefore, mm-hmm. I'm going to shut it all down.
Yeah, I think that's the most tragic thing that some people misunderstand about immigrants is like, immigrants are the bravest, like, people that are just like trying to construct themselves from scratch in a different place for the betterment of themselves or for their family. And there's no malicious intent there. It's not about you. Something that I really appreciate is that you mentioned that you stand up for all immigrants. And I think that me and Anna have kind of learned through this podcast that we're more similar than not. Like, we relate to so many different kinds of immigrants. And I think that's the beautiful thing about, I mean, maybe just being people of color, but I like that you talk about like the work ethic, because I think Anna and I can also relate to like our parents instilled in us this ridiculous work ethic that we just hustle constantly. And I think it's just like from watching our parents do the same thing and from them telling us like, you just have to work hard, because that's what they did to survive.
Yeah.
And also just like accents. Like, I hate that people think people with accents are like less intelligent, when really it's the complete opposite. They're talking in like their third or second language. And it's like, immigrants are smarter than you. Like, that's just the, yeah.
Well, first of all, again, if you get up to come here, there's a drive for some reason, whether it's you're escaping a bad thing or you thought there's a better thing here. So you have a drive. As you said, you got to learn the other language. You got to make it happen. And this runs the gamut from those who are here, let's say on a scholarship, who are the top of their class, and those who might not have all of those, that kind of intelligence, but they come here and they go, I got to figure something out.
Yeah.
And first of all, the thing of all immigrants, when I first started doing stand-up comedy, because you said, you know, you resisted, Shireen, getting into like labeling yourself as Syrian and this and that. Well, they also say, write what you know. Talk about what you know. Mm-hmm. Well, if you're going to write something about somebody living with their parents or something, you probably write about your parents. Like, every time I've done a sitcom that I've pitched as a TV show, I've always included a character based on my mom, because I always say, that's my mom. And she's got an accent. She's this Persian lady and whatever, whatever, whatever. So you write what you know. But at a certain point, as a stand-up, I started realizing that a lot of immigrants have a lot in common. And that was when I used to do a joke about my grandmother and how she used to keep her cash in her bra. And the joke was something along the lines of, we thought she was a D cup until we went to buy a house and she pulled the down payment out from her bra and we realized she was an A cup. Then we looked closer, we realized she was actually grandpa. So that was the joke. But I did that joke one time at the Laugh Factory, and there was these girls in the audience that looked Latina. They might have been Mexican, Guatemalan, I don't know where they were from, but they were falling out of their chairs laughing. And it made me go, oh, Mexican grandmothers keep their money in their bra.
Yeah.
Arab grandmothers keep their money in their bra. I've even talked to people who say Southern grandmothers. So there's a lot of people associated with that. And then you go, wait a minute. So if I say immigrants as opposed to just Iranians, I'm opening the door up for a lot more people to, first of all, embrace me, but also I think they're going to get it. And also, even if you're not an immigrant, you have a friend whose, you know, grandmother, grandfather was of that kind. And in the end, like, that's why, again, sometimes I get so disappointed in my own people. I don't know what you guys experienced with your family, your friends and all this, but like, when the whole Black Lives Matter thing happened, there was a lot of Iranians who were just like, well, you know, this is these guys, you know, black lives, well, you know, they should work hard and this and that. And I go, you guys, when we came from Iran in the early 80s to America and the hostage situation happened, it was totally illogical, but they would beat up us Iranians who had fled Iran, and we were against the government of Iran, and the government of Iran took the hostages, but we'd get beaten up for it. And I said, you guys came to this country, you've been you know, bullied, you've been beaten up, you've had a lot happen where you were discriminated against as a community. And now when there's another community coming forward, whether it's immigrants coming from Central America or from Syria or wherever, or the Black Lives Matter or any of this stuff, I said, when this stuff happens, you got to be sympathetic to these movements, because I think it's important that we stand together and fight those powers that be, because those powers that be, really, whether they see us all as the same, or maybe right now they don't see us the same, but you give us 6 months, your turn's coming up. They will come after you. They'll come after the next person. So that's what disappoints me when I see our own community sometimes turning their back to certain causes that seem very, you know, justified to me.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a I have a lot to say about it just based off my own conversations with my dad. But we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back after this. And we're back.
We're back.
So, Maz, before the break, you were talking kind of about,
I guess, like the colorism.
Yeah, like, colorism and like kind of inherent racism that immigrants have at times. And a part of that, you know, my dad has come a long way as an Iranian immigrant in this country. You know, there is sort of something I've learned over the years is, you know, growing up, my dad, we lived in the Bay Area as well, but we were more in like Berkeley, Oakland, East Bay. And, you know, my older brother was always in trouble. He was hanging out, whatever, with just kids. And my dad always had a way of being like, the Black kids are the ones who are getting him in trouble. And for a long time, we'd always be like, no, Dad, I don't think that's right. You shouldn't say that. And he would always say it. And me and my siblings would always make a point to point, like call him out and be like, no, you can't say that. And it took a very long time that, you know, like a few years back, I heard him start to be like, okay, you know what? You're right. I shouldn't say that. And it took, what, like 30 years for him to like finally be like, okay, yes, I understand what I'm saying is racist and I shouldn't generalize like that. And it's like, it just took us constantly being like, that's racist, Dad. That's racist. You don't consider yourself racist. Why are you saying these racist things? And it took me a while also just doing this podcast to really understand where he was coming from, is that the system built by rich white men oppresses these people in these countries who've never even come to America before. They are told from day one, white is best. So to them, when they come to this country, they're thinking, I have to be and act and try and blend in with the white people as much as I can, because that's the ruling class. So like they just come in with this mindset of like, I have to be like them. And if they are being racist towards Black people, then you know what? If that makes them respect me, then I will be racist towards Black people. And it's this kind of like sick, ingrained racism that was just built by this country telling people that you have to be like us or you're not going to fit in and we will be racist towards you as well. And it's so fucked up. It's so fucked up.
I think that colorism is kind of tied into just trying to be the model minority in a lot of ways. And also a lot of immigrants in so many different cultures trying to undo like internalized homophobia and racism that they don't even know that exists. And I think especially when you can be white passing, when you have that light skin privilege, I think it's hard to not be like, well, I've struggled too. I've just worked hard. Yeah. And I really appreciate that you can realize that by saying immigrants, like it worked for me. Like, even though I wasn't Persian, it worked for me growing up. I didn't even realize you weren't Arab, to be honest, until I was like a little bit older and realized there was even a difference there. I think you had that quality that just like united everybody into being like, I relate to this thing that you're saying. And I think that's a beautiful thing about your comedy, is that it was so funny and not at all being like, this is only for me and my culture. Because again, even doing this podcast, we're realizing we're so much more alike than different. Like, not just me and Anna, but like us and every single ethnicity that's come on our show. But let's get back to you. Before I want to ask about the Axis of Evil, because I think it's just a brilliant thing that you did post 9/11 and everything. But so you're in Marin County, like in California. When did you realize that you were interested in comedy or were trying to be an entertainer at all?
So when I was 10 or so, was when Eddie Murphy became big. It was early 80s, and I just loved Eddie Murphy. Maybe I was like 8. I don't know what the age was, but I was a kid, and I started seeing Eddie Murphy, and I was like, oh, I love what this guy's doing. And then back then, again, our parents, immigrant parents, don't pay attention to what you're watching or listening to. Yeah. And Eddie Murphy was cussing. Mm-hmm. Every other word was a cuss. But we had, back then, it was before his most famous special was called Delirious before Raw. It was Delirious. Well, before Delirious, which was a video, he had another special. It was called just Eddie Murphy Comedian. It was on a tape. So we put the tape in and we'd listen with my friends. And I was like, oh, I love what this guy's doing. Then I wanted to be like him. And when I was in seventh grade, we had a musical and I auditioned for the musical because I think they probably said like, oh, we need more guys. We have enough girls. We need more guys. I was like, let me try this. So went, got on stage, loved being on stage. One of the things that I remember was the director had said, when you're on stage in a musical, you got to always be smiling. When you're singing, you got to be smiling. And I was a background. I was one of the background because it was seventh and eighth grade and we were seventh graders. So we had the smaller parts. And one day I was sick. I go to rehearsal and I go to the director. I go, hey, Miss Bonbright, I'm a little under the weather today, but I came because I know it's important for me to be here. You've instilled in us this idea that you got to be here. And I'm singing and dancing and I'm smiling. And she stops the whole rehearsal. Everybody stop. Everybody stop. She goes, look at him. Look at him. He's sick, but he came here today and he's smiling and you should all learn from him. And it was kind of a positive reinforcement. I go, oh, wow, I'm good at this. And so the next year in eighth grade, I got the lead in a play called Little Abner. It was a musical. And then in high school, I was in a theater program. And all the time, every time I would do a play or do some kind of theatrical thing, the teacher, the coach, the director would always say, hey, you've got what it takes to do this. And then my parents would say, that bitch is crazy. Don't listen to her. So that was kind of the back and forth. And so I got kind of detoured. I went and studied political science for my undergrad because I thought I'd be a lawyer to please my parents.
Yeah.
Then while I was in college, I studied a year in Italy. I studied abroad. And while I was there, there was this professor and I fell in love with what he was doing. I go, maybe I can be a professor because that might make my parents happy. Mm-hmm. And it would make me be able to stand in front of people and talk. So I got into a PhD program at UCLA, started that. But that first semester, first whatever it was, quarter that I was there, I went and auditioned for the main stage play, got into the play, and I was going, oh, this is what I love. So I was alive on stage again. And it took a lot of back and forth. I dropped out of grad school right away. I ended up working at an ad agency, and I was in my mid-20s. I was 26 years old when I was at the ad agency, was doing a play just for fun, was making a copy of the play to give to the other actors. And there was a guy there who was in his mid-60s at the time. His name was Joe Rhine. And Joe was just the sweetest guy in the world. And he saw me making the dub of this video. And he saw my play that I was doing. It was a comedy. And he goes, hey, you're good at this. Have you ever thought about doing this? I said, Joe, when I was a kid, I wanted to do it. In college, I wanted to do it. Da, 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 da. My parents keep talking me out of it. I go, I'm going to save up some money. And maybe when I'm in my 30s, I'll go for it. And this is when I was 26 years old. And Joe sits me down in his office. He goes, listen, I am now in my 60s. He goes, when I was in my 20s, there were some things I wanted to do. I just never got around to doing it. So he goes, if you really want to do it, just do it. And wow. It was a light bulb moment. And I signed up for some improv comedy classes right away. And then from there, I just went. And that was 22 years ago.
That's amazing. My whole life, everything I had wanted to do, it seemed like either my parents like, that's a hobby, or that's not realistic. And every single time, whether it was poetry or photography, comedy, and then eventually filmmaking, you just have to really do it for yourself at some point and try to get your parents' voice out of your head. My mom, I think, is still hoping I'll go to law school. You know what I mean? But that's okay. I remember at one point we were watching Judge Judy and she's like, you love to argue. Don't you want to be Judge Judy? And I'm like, I want to be on TV. Yeah, but I don't need to be a judge. But anyway,
that's a classic. You like to argue. You might as well be a lawyer. And it's like, I'm like, arguing you're so with difficult you to leave me alone.
But I think it's funny, the little, how we reconcile with ourselves, like, oh, my being a professor will let me be on stage and thinking that'll be enough to satisfy that drive. But good for that guy for sitting you down and telling you, like, go for it. Because sometimes we need to hear it, right? Just to like believe it's real. And I'm so glad you did, because
yeah. I mean, there is that struggle of like, you're not getting that support from your parents, because to them, you're like crazy. They think you're mm-hmm. out of your mind for taking such a risk. And my parents didn't start being like, law school's waiting, basically, until I started, like, my job gave me health insurance. Then my dad was finally like, okay, well, what's the salary? Okay, so you can live on your own, you don't need me? And then he was like, And then I guess he did the math and decided he wasn't going to bother me anymore. But even now, like, I have a career, I have a job, I make good money. He still goes, okay, but just in case you're laid off, what's your plan then? And I'm like, oh my God, just like, let me breathe. Yeah. They're always
they worry about you.
Yeah. Yeah.
They worry about it.
It all comes from that.
And they want what's best. It's kind of the analogy I use is when you're driving and you have someone in the passenger seat. When you're the driver, you go, I'm in control. I got it. The person mm-hmm. in the passenger seat keeps going, oh my God, slow down. Oh my God, that turn. Your parents are the people in the passenger seat and they're worried for you. Yeah. But that's why two things got to happen. Number one, if you're lucky enough to find a passion, you should go for it. Number two, procrastinating. I'm guilty of it during this lockdown. I've been wanting to write stuff and I just keep putting it off. You got to make a plan. You got to get in there. Like the people that I see, I have a lot of friends that are writer friends and they say, yeah, I get up at whatever it is, 8 o'clock and write for 4 hours or whatever. You got to put in a plan and you got to do it. You can't just say, oh, I want to be the next whoever, you know, I want to be the next Kevin Hart or whoever it is, but you don't put in the time. You got to put in the time. And if you're lucky enough to have found what you love doing, you should just do it.
Yeah. I think you brought up something earlier about how, like, initially you might shy away from being different and then eventually you realize, like, that's what makes you, like, you write what you know kind of thing. For me, I never wanted to exploit being Syrian or my family. Like, I love writing about my family, and like the current thing I'm working on is all about being Syrian. But I never wanted to seem like I was exploiting them, because I was like, well, what if I'm not Syrian enough? Like, all my cousins that aren't the American cousin, what if they feel like they're being exploited by me? Like, did you ever feel like you... Like, not that you're... Like, obviously not representing the entire culture, but did you ever get any back... like lash from your parents or your family when you started to incorporate your culture into your work?
Not really. I mean, I honestly feel like this is my take, right? So you take, especially with stand-up, you take something that comes from your life and you exaggerate it, or you give that that line or voice, that idea to somebody else. But I think it was new enough that they were just kind of laughing and there for the ride. I mean, my mom was the butt of a lot of jokes.
Yeah.
And she still says things sometimes where I go, that's got to go into my act, or it's got to go into a character, because that's where you get your material. And now I've got kids, so I get material from them and then my wife. And so, you know, you got to take from your life, I think. I mean, the TV show Rami, that I think is one of the best shows on TV, he talks about his parents and he shows you the vulnerabilities and he goes deep. And a lot of it's about him just trying to get laid in New York City. I mean, so, and by the way, also, I would never make myself out to be perfect. Mm-hmm. You know, even in my stand-up, a lot of my stand-up starts with self-deprecating material to say, I'm going to be making fun of everybody. It's actually kind of funny, because earlier this year, before the lockdown, I was in Atlanta doing a show. Now, what's interesting for my show, here's an interesting thing. When you do this stuff, you can choose what you talk about, but you can't choose your fans. Mm-hmm. They just find you. And sometimes you have the fans that you go, oh my God, I love this person because this is the kind of fan I want. They're a comedy fan. They, you know, follow everything I do. They get it. They're cool with me experimenting with stuff, blah, 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 whatever. Sometimes you get a fan and you go, how is that person my fan? I have no idea. So I was doing a show in Atlanta, and there's a lot of times the older women from, you know, in the Persian community, we're talking like 60s, 70s. Mm-hmm. They'll show up and they'll be like, I love this. This is Maz Jobrani. We love you. This is great. Da, da, da. And I'm not sure if they've seen a lot of my stuff. And I'm not sure if how they're going to feel when I do a joke where I go, I support the gay community. I don't know if they're going to be so conservative. They're like, Maz, this is too much. You're going too far. So it was just kind of funny because I was doing some joke where I was making fun of my dad. I forget what it was, using his, you know, he was kind of the punchline, or something he had said was the punchline. It wasn't necessarily, again, you're not really making fun of them. You're saying like, whatever, like a joke I used to do, I used to say, as a father now, I say, we spent a lot more time with our kids than our parents did with us. That just wasn't the norm back then. And especially immigrant parents, not at all.
Yeah.
And I talk about how I go, when I was a kid, I used to have to play with the kids of my parents' friends. Now I have to play with the parents of my kids' friends. And then I act that out where like I go to a party and as soon as we walk in, my dad's saying, go play with Amir.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm 5 years old. I go, I don't want to play with Amir. He's like, go play with Amir. And I'm like, Amir's 29 years old. And he's like, that's not my problem. That's his problem. Till he gets married, he's their son. Go play with him. So some joke along that line, I was talking to, you know, my dad. And there was this older Persian lady. She must have been around 70 or so. She was kind of seated towards the front of the stage. And I just saw the look of disdain in her face. And she kind of under her breath, I think even, it might have been in Farsi. Mm-hmm. I think it might have been in Farsi, but she was like, okay, that's enough about your father. Like, that's enough. Like, stop disrespecting your father, basically. And it was so funny to me because I finished the joke and then I turn around, I go, I just saw this lady get mad at me for my dad joke. I go, I've been spending my whole life. I go, this is like a psychotherapy session. Yeah. I go, I've been trying to get them off my shoulders. I finally feel bold enough to talk about my life on stage. And now I got a lady over here acting as the community judging me.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
To take your point of worrying about all these people, you just can't because they're always going to judge you. They're always going to say something. How do you know about, you don't know about Syria. You want to know Syria? Come sit with me. I'll tell you about Syria. Especially now with social media. I get people, you know, shitting on me for some joke or something. And my response really is either I ignore them or in the back of my mind, I'm going, look, if you're really that upset, then go start your own comedy career and do your own jokes. You know, I can't please everybody.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that is the thing is you're not for everyone. And I, you know, when we started this podcast and all of a sudden I was like, oh, now all of a sudden I'm like a commentator on all these things. And it's like, I didn't want that. As soon as I did it because I wanted people like us to not feel alone, to be like, hey, we go through all the same stuff, you know, we've experienced and, you know, had to fight our parents over things that they weren't like happy with. And then all of a sudden it was like, people would be like tweeting at me like, well, what are your thoughts on this thing that happened in the Middle East? And I'd be like, it's not great. And then it was just like, I felt all this pressure to have to comment on things. And, you know, a lot of the time I don't speak a lot about certain more aggressive things the Iranian government is doing because my entire family's in Iran and I go to Iran every 2 to 3 years. And it's very hard to be like, I'm sorry, I have to sell out in that sense of like, I want to go to Iran and not be arrested and held in solitary confinement for the next 5 years of my life. And so I have to pick and choose what I talk about. And it's like, yes, I have been very hard on MBS and I will never step foot in Saudi Arabia. But it also scares me because my mom is a devout Muslim and goes to Hajj she goes on pilgrimage. And that, it all scares me. And it's like, I really have to pick and choose. But then I also at the same time feel the pressure to condemn certain actions because I'm the child of Middle Eastern immigrants. But it's like, I'm not for everyone. I'm not a journalist. I'm an idiot they gave a podcast to who also happens to be Iranian American and enjoys talking about Middle Eastern politics and culture. But then I still, it's like, if you want to do it, start your own podcast. Exactly. It's like, do your own thing. Make what you want to hear and put out because we can't give everyone everything they need.
Yeah. And I think it's just a symptom of sometimes being the sole Persian or sole Syrian person someone knows. I think that's what it is. It's like, I'm the only Syrian a lot of people know. And I can't tell you the amount of times the first question someone asks me is like, what do you think of ISIS? You know what I mean? Like, what do you think I think of ISIS? Like, I don't know. Like, but
love
I think
it.
That's, yeah. But to maybe try to segue this into Axis of Evil, actually, let's take one more break first, and then we'll get into the Axis of Evil. We'll be right back. Bless you. What do you say in Farsi? In Arabic, you say Saha.
Saha. Afiyat boshe.
That's too long.
Afiyat.
Afiyat?
Afiyat boshe.
Let's keep that in. Can we keep your sneezing? We're back.
Sure. Hatchu.
We're back. I want to ask you about the Axis of Evil. I think there's something so intelligent about having a crew, like a comedian like group made up of all these ethnicities that people are afraid of, especially post 9/11. And I was trying to tie it into kind of being the usually like the one Middle Easterner someone knows. So I really appreciate that you guys all like rallied together and decided to do this thing. But I want to know the origins of it. Like, how did that come about?
So I was a regular at the Comedy Store. Comedy Store is this comedy club in Los Angeles, one of the most famous clubs in the world. All the big names in comedy have gone through there. And the way you become a regular is you used to, before she passed away, perform in front of the owner. Her name is Mitzi Shore. She's Pauly Shore's mother. And you do 3 minutes. And if she likes you, she says, come back in a week or two, do 6 minutes, come back, do 10 minutes. Eventually you become a regular. So I was a regular. But what regular means is you would call on a Monday and say, hey, I'm available these next few nights. And then they would call you and say, okay, you're on at 11:30 on Wednesday and at midnight on Thursday. Mm-hmm. And the lineups are all kinds of people from well-known celebrities to people starting out. So I was doing my thing. And Mitzi was notorious for once in a while taking a group of comedians that fit a certain description that are regulars at the club and doing a theme night around them. So she would do the women of the Comedy Store, and she would like throw it up every 6 months. Latino night, you know, black night. So Mitzi, she was a Jewish American woman, but she loved watching the news. And this was in the early, I think it was in the 2000s when there was a intifada in the Middle East, the Palestinians, the Israelis, conflict. Mitzi has an epiphany. She goes, I think there's going to be a need for a positive voice for Muslims and Middle Easterners in the near future.
Wow.
This is before September
11th.
Yeah. Yeah. Almost like Yoda. She was like, I feel something's coming. So at the time, we get the word, do you know any other comedians that are Arab or Middle Eastern or whatever? So Ahmed, who's Egyptian American, was doing shows at the club. He wasn't a regular yet, but he was doing shows at the club because you can also do shows that are booked by other people that aren't through the club. But Mitzi had seen him, so she brought him in and said, you're now a regular. I had seen Aaron Kader one time, and I said, oh, there's a guy, he's half Palestinian, half Mormon. Maybe he would fit. Brought him in. A friend of mine, Sam Tripoli, whose mother is Armenian, he fit in. Like anybody who was close to being Middle Eastern at all or Muslim was in. So we had an Indian guy was in. We had a white girl who knew how to belly dance. She was in. I swear, it was the craziest thing. And so Mitzi goes, I want to do the Arabian Nights. She wants to call it Arabian Nights. Now, Iranians, as you know, Anna, they are very adamant about, we are not Arab, we are Persian, it's different.
I've gotten so offended so many times about this, especially when people assume that I'm Persian, which is fine. Like, what bothers me is that when I am assumed to be Persian, I don't mind because my name is Persian. But then when
Iranians,
it's reversed.
Let me just give you a little bit. It actually goes back to Anna's thing with her dad being, you know, racist and learning how to not to be racist. Iranians also have a thing where, especially Iranians after the Islamic Revolution, I think a lot of Iranians blame Islam for what's happened to this country that was this Persian empire, that was this beautiful place that had all this amazing stuff. And so a lot of Iranians were turned off by religion. I mean, I'm very secular. A lot of Iranians are closer to being Zoroastrians, which was the first religion of Iran historically. You know, I read an article years ago in the National Geographic. This guy went to Iran and was just trying to show all the beauty of Iran, nature, this and that. And he said what was interesting was that as part of the article, I forget if it was a guy or girl who wrote it, but they said as part of the article, they would ask Iranians, what do you want the world to know about you? And he said the first thing they wanted the world to know was, we're not Arab. The second thing they wanted the world to know, we're not terrorists. So really, being Arab in their mind was worse than being a terrorist. And that's simply because I don't think that there are there's definitely some Iran. We all have, I mean, a lot of immigrant cultures are very racist. And I think there's a lot of, even within the Arab community, when you go, I'll have a Lebanese. I go, "You're Arab?" They go, "No, we're Lebanese. We're not Arab." I go, "Well, what isn't that a kind of Arab? Like, what am I doing?"
There's
here?
Definitely a hierarchy that people assume that there is. Yeah. Yeah.
Everyone's got their hierarchy. So with that said, anyway, what was interesting was Mitzi calls it the Arabian Nights. But she's the boss and we got to do it. And inevitably, a lot of Iranians would come to these shows. And afterwards, we had a great time. Like, they were friendly with everybody. But, you know, by the way, Iranians aren't Arabs. Uh-huh. You know that. I go, I know that. It's just the name this old Jewish American lady gave. So we were touring. And eventually what happened was September 11th happens. And then, of course, because of September 11th, we get a lot of attention. We were in, you know, New York Times, Time Magazine, all kinds of interviews, you name it, we were there. And eventually the core group became me, Ahmed, and Aaron, because we were the real people who had, you know, our cultures really did have Middle Eastern backgrounds, you know. So we continued to tour as that. And then eventually we decided to come up with a new name. And that was after George Bush had said there's an axis of evil, which was Iran, Iraq, and North Korea. So we decided to lampoon that name by calling it the Axis of Evil Comedy Tour. And then we recorded it. And in 2007, it came out as a comedy special on Comedy Central. And that really brought us, I think, made us much better known to the general population. The special came out. People were buying the DVD. We were getting emails from people in America saying, "Wow, I never knew Middle Eastern people laughed. Thank you so much." I swear, one person was saying, you know, when September 11th happened, I hated Muslims, I hated Arabs, but when I saw you guys, changed my mind. There's good people everywhere. I mean, things like that that we never thought, we didn't set out to do that.
Yeah.
But that's what was coming with it. And then we even got a chance to go to the Middle East and perform, and we performed for the King of Jordan. And it was like the first time that there was a group of comedians from America coming to the Middle East to tour for the people of the Middle East, as opposed to like the American troops. So it really was this, I think that put us all on the map. And that was 2007, 2008. And from there, it just, you know, you just keep going.
Yeah. I mean, that's like, you've pioneered like comedy for Middle Easterners everywhere. And I think that's why when we opened all this, I said, you're iconic. Because to me, you are.
Yeah.
And I know maybe it's weird to hear it, but it's true. Like, that's the fact that you literally took a quote that George Bush said about these countries and you were like, let's use that to our advantage. It's brilliant.
Well, you know, we were first out the gate. And also, I think the other thing is, I think all of our people feel, you know, sometimes nowadays people will get upset. They say, stick to comedy. And I'm like, well, you stick to accounting, because comedy is politics. This is what we do. And the fact that Axis of Evil was Axis of Evil, you know, in a way, you're getting your message across in a subversive way. I heard D.L. Hughley say one time that comedy is like giving people their medicine, but in orange juice so they don't taste it. So throughout my career, as much as I've wanted to be known not as the Iranian-American comedian, but a comedian that happens to be Iranian-American, a lot of my subjects or titles in the specials have dealt with some sort of political misunderstanding or trying to normalize me and my community to say we laugh, we cry, we win awards, we commit crimes, we have everything that you see on any other TV show or anything. Our people do it as well. And we aren't terrorists and we aren't the enemy.
Yeah. Right. I think comedy has that unique ability to humanize more than a lot of other mediums. Because everyone loves to laugh. And if you're able to humanize a race or ethnicity that people only associate with the violence they see that the news broadcasts, like, I think that's a really good feat. And the fact that you can remember this feedback that you got is just very telling of that, from people that said that, like, Middle Easterners can laugh.
I mean, I think that's what we were trying to do with this podcast as well, is give people, like, the news that's coming out of the Middle East in like a digestible format, which is just two Middle Eastern kids also trying to process it. I mean, did it work?
Yeah.
Maybe. Who knows at this point?
Yeah.
I do want to talk about your podcast that you have right now. It's called Back to School. And I want to know how that came about. Did you go back to school, literally?
No, what happened was, so I used to do a podcast with Al Madrigal and Chris Spencer. Uh-huh. For those who don't know Al, Al was a correspondent on The Daily Show. He and Bill Burr have the All Things Comedy Network. Mm-hmm. He's a friend of mine, stand-up writer, producer, all of the above. Chris Spencer is a writer. He's, you know, always active, always like, right. He just wrote on the Emmys recently. He's writes for Kevin Hart. He had a show with Kevin Hart. Anyway, the three of us are all dads. So we had a show, we had a podcast called Minivan Men, and we just get together and talk about being dads. And it was really fun. And it was early in the podcast kind of, mm-hmm. it was like 10 years ago or something. So it's pretty early. And we all got busy and we stopped. And then for years, I was like, well, I want to do one, but I didn't know what. So finally, in trying to find a theme that I liked, I was like, well, you know, in my stand-up, I talk about politics and parenting. So I was like, what about like a podcast called Politics and Parenting? I was like, that's pretty good. And then as we were looking, I thought, well, what about something about where I could still talk about those things, but it's a little more, a title is a little more broad. Mm-hmm. And the reason I came up with Back to School was because my kids, they're now 12 and 9, they would ask me questions I didn't have the answers for, whether it was like, why does it rain, or what year did such a thing happen, or what colors are this, whatever it was. I was constantly going like, I don't know, I got to Google it. And I was like, I got to be like a Neil deGrasse Tyson or somebody, you know, to know these answers. So I said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to start bringing in these experts in these fields and we'll learn from them. So we just started. And we just started booking professors from UCLA or people that I knew, authors, professors. And it was great because, first of all, you realize, wow, people are doing some amazing things in the world. Secondly, you realize there's so many amazing stories out there. So we had, for example, there's a guy, he's an Iranian guy named Firuz Nadiri, who used to work for the JPL, Jet Propulsion Laboratory for NASA. And he was one of the guys that helped land the rover on Mars. And wow. Hearing him tell the story is amazing.
Mohawk.
Because the Mohawk dude is the younger guy. Oh. Firuz is the older dude. The Mohawk guy became like some like a heartthrob for the Iranian community.
Oh.
But Firuz tells the story of, I mean, this was crazy. He was telling us about it. He goes, they've been trying to land something on Mars forever. And what would happen is it would get close and then it would just self-destruct because mm-hmm. whatever, the atmosphere, something didn't work. So he told the story. He said it took, I think, like 4 years or so to build the thing, get it ready, get it on the right shuttle, take it all the way there. And he goes, the amount of time it takes for something to transmit information from Mars back to Earth was about like 8 minutes or something. So he goes, we see it going into the orbit, we see it going down, and then we see it like it disappears off of our radar. So we don't know what happened. Uh-huh. And he goes, for 8 minutes, we're all just sitting there staring at the screen. And he goes, finally, like mission control goes, rover has landed. And he goes, I just started crying. He's like, oh my, like all these years of this work mm-hmm. to do that. I mean, it's so you hear these amazing stories, whether it's him or we had a lady whose name I forget right now, but she is a cave diver. She dives underneath the earth and goes into caves with scientists that want to study living organisms underneath. So she'll go underneath the cave. Like, I don't know if you guys remember a couple of years ago, there was a group of kids in, I think it was in South America. They went
in Thailand
on a hike in a cave. Was it Thailand?
Yeah,
Thailand. Went into a cave and then the water rose and they were stuck. And now cave divers had to come and rescue them. Like that's that kind of person.
Whoa.
So it covers a lot of stuff. And like more recently, like this week I've got, well, I don't know when yours is going to run, but I've had, you know, I'm trying to also highlight Iranian Americans doing stuff. So I've got an Iranian American woman named Yasemin Ansari, who's running for city council in Phoenix.
Nice.
I've got another woman named Sima for Texas. She's running for Congress. I've got some great political minds. I love politics. So there's a guy named Frank Figluisi. I think I'm saying his last name wrong. He's a former FBI deputy director who's always on MSNBC. He's going to come on and talk about the elections and what's going on and security. And so there's That's basically so fun. Back to school can cover everything.
We're all going to school here.
We're
is
all
the
going
point.
To school. Yeah.
I thought at first you were going to have your kid ask the questions and have the people answer them like on the podcast. I think that's a good idea.
No, he asks the first question. So the night before every show, I'll tell him or my daughter, one of them, but I'll say, for example, oh, tomorrow I've got Firuz Nadiri. He's the guy who landed rover on Mars. And then I'll say, what's your question? And then they'll come up with a question like, did your parents want you to become an astronaut or whatever?
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, that's a good, we'll start
I think
with
you'll
that.
Be funny a couple years from now when your kids are like a little bit older. It's not going to be like endearing anymore. It's just going to be like, no. Like someone asking a question.
Yeah.
I'm so excited for you. And we'll link everything in the footnotes where you can listen to the podcast and all of that. I can't tell you how amazing it's been to talk to you. You are so great, and you deserve all the success that you have and more.
Well, thank you. I'm blushing. I appreciate you guys. You guys are awesome. Thank you guys. And
my
thank
parents
you for
are
doing
going
what
to
you
be
guys
so
are
happy.
Yeah, I need to tell my parents. Last thing my mom texted me was, Inshallah, you have been washing your hands. And I'm like, oh my God. No, mom.
The what do you think?
Yeah, of course you have to capitalize the Allah. Inshallah, I have been. Who knows?
Yeah.
You'll never know, mom.
Well, for those of you that live under a rock and don't follow him already, where can the people follow Master Brani?
Well, I'm on social media across the board on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. It's at Maz Jobrani, MazJobrani. My special is on Netflix. It's called Immigrant. And the podcast is called Back to School with Maz Jobrani. So there's plenty of ways to follow me, see me. And if you're following me, drop me a line. I usually answer the emails and just say hi and all that stuff.
Yeah, I'm going to be happy for at least another day because of this.
Until you read the news and you're like, oh no.
Right. And then I'll listen to Maz Jobrani Back to School and then I'll be fine.
Speaking of, you know, what's really fun to me right now is that we're like edging towards like a coup. And one of my favorite books is All the Shah's Men, because that's how I learned all about the coup that went down in Iran. I mean, dude, coups. Coups are the most fascinating thing. And I think we should do a coup episode because we need to teach people what to do in case there's a coup. I'm like a coup head.
In
I don't
case,
know.
In case of a coup, I think you stay home and wash your hands.
Yes.
Those are the two things.
Inshallah, if there's a coup.
You heard it here first. You heard it here first. Stay home and wash your hands.
Stay
okay,
calm.
Okay, I'm going to wrap us out of here. This is Ethnically Ambiguous. It's Ethnically Amb, A-M-B on Twitter, and Ethnically Ambig, A-M-B-I-G on Instagram. I'm Shireen. It's Shirohiro on Instagram and Shirohiro666 on Twitter.
And I'm at Anna Hussein on Twitter.
And until next time, y'all, listen to Back to School. Bye!
Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Maz. Ethnically Ambiguous is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.